back in the 1780s, when some people were pushing to get a new government to replace that created by the Articles of Confederation. People like Patrick Henry were very outspoken that the proposed Constitution was basically a ticket for far too much power in the executive branch. A lot of folks have forgotten that the Constitution was not sufficiently ratified by the states until they added the Bill of Rights, which the original proposal did not have. It was good enough for Delaware, but, you know. So there was a lot of conflict as far as how much power the federal government should have, but it was ratified in 1780. The Constitution was written and initially signed in 1787, I think. And barely 10 years later, you've got John Adams with the Alien and Sedition Acts, and the government's basically got the right to throw journalists in jail for criticizing the government, which was a complete travesty as far as the Bill of Rights and the First Amendment, but it didn't matter.
Yeah, and you know, it was really nice that they finally got rid of that in its entirety, and no journalists have ever been imprisoned or incarcerated or persecuted for what they've written since then.
Yeah, well, it doesn't make sense to place blind trust in the federal government or the Supreme Court to uphold one's rights and liberties. People have got to be willing and able and courageous enough to do that on their own.
Boy, ain't that the truth. You know, one of the things that you wrote in that chapter, in fact, I was so impressed with it, I typed it out and put it up on Facebook as the thought for the day. You wrote, we have seen that the consent of the governed is in most cases a mirage. The fact that people live in a certain place indicates that they consent to the weather as much as they consent to the government. The mere invocation of the people's name cannot automatically legitimate an unlimited amount of coercion of the people. And that got me thinking about this whole consent of the governed part that I wanted to ask you about. As I understand it, there are just two ways in which people can interact with one another, by mutual agreement or by somebody coercing the other through violence or something along that order. I guess you could say the first is consent, both sides willingly and voluntarily entering into an agreement of some sort to what's going to be done. And the second you could label as governing, one person taking control over another. So this consent and governed part being used in the same concept are pretty much opposite then, right? The concept of consent of the governed is a contradiction. If there's mutual consent, it's not government. If there's governing, then there's no consent. So? What about that?
I would not necessarily go that far. I think that there are some ways, some things that would be possible to get some limited agreement for a concord of limited purposes, which a very small, weak government could be.
But doesn't it run into the brick wall of logic to say, I give my consent for you to be robbed? That's what democracy is, right? Well, we all took this vote for the 16th Amendment, and now we say it's perfectly okay for men with guns to go to Jim Bovard's place up there in Maryland and take 30-40% of his hard-earned money.
Well, yeah, that's a negative.
That's
no, I mean, this is a complex topic, and I'm in favor of minimizing the power of government. Whether or not we can do without any government anytime soon is another question.
Well, I agree. I find it rather provocative in the sense that under the concept of consent, somebody would be stupid enough to say, I agree to let you forcibly control me.
You know, there was a saying that Aristotle had. He said that some men are born to be slaves. And, seeing how docile so many people have been over the last few decades in this country as far as government power grabs, I'm amazed that there's not been more of a consistent pushback against the NSA wiretapping and vacuuming up our email. There's a handful of folks I know who are still outraged by that, but it's kind of like, okay, so who's in the Super Bowl?
I think it's got to be put in a context that motivates them, as you did in this Chapter 6. In order to live in a society and under a government, is it necessary that people be ridden like horses, fleeced like sheep, worked like cattle, and fed and clothed like swine and hounds, quoting John Adams there? Does the fact that one person has a badge and a uniform and a gun give them an unlimited right to forcibly intrude into other people's lives? It is the talent and providing the information in paragraphs like that that I would think to a person who hadn't given it serious thought before that would be a bit of an epiphany.
Well, I was certainly trying to plant the seeds of thoughts in readers' minds and certainly trying to get folks chewing on, at least asking these questions. As the next paragraph was talking about the issue whether government inherently possesses some type of higher sanction that sanctifies its coercion of the citizenry. And, okay, you had an election. Does that give the people that won the right to kill you? I don't think so, but if you look at some of Obama's rhetoric on his targeted killing program and his right to do secret assassinations, and it was Eric Holder was kicking and screaming to avoid admitting that maybe Obama did not have that power to kill Americans here at home. It took a long filibuster by Rand Paul before Holder would even kind of grudgingly concede on that point.
Under the heading of consent of the governed, it's difficult to extrapolate from that that consent, forget about the analysis of it that I made earlier, but if that consent would go so far as to allow the government that came into existence through the consent of the governed, that it was also extended to them this unspoken power to invent their own rights.
Very true. And now it's interesting, when I was writing Freedom and Change, I spent a lot of time going back and reading some of the wonderful writing by English authors in the 1600s, when there was some very lively arguments about the rights of the king and at what point that the king would forfeit that, because the Brits had a series of bad kings at that point. Charles I met his got the end that he deserved at the end of an execution. And some of the British English writers pointed out that once the king violates the law and breaks his sacred compact with the people, then he's no longer king, because he was granted that power. It was a limited power on specific terms. And once he violated the terms by which he ascended to power, he no longer had the right to power over people.
Well, who was the first one to go and tell that to the king?
Well, it wasn't Cromwell, but maybe Hampton, I don't know. I mean, it was a very wide, it wasn't majority belief necessarily, but it was a widely held belief. And it's interesting, looking at British history, I think it was in 1628 that the House of Commons passed, I'm not sure if it was a law or what, but it was called the Petition of Right. And it was a binding offer to King Charles I that he'd be allowed to hold power and the House of Commons would raise taxes for him if he made a formal agreement not to abuse his power in the following 5 or 10 ways. Well, King Charles signed that act, signed that Petition of Right, got the higher tax revenue, and then trampled the hell out of everybody's rights and completely ignored the agreement that he signed and acted like that it was impossible to have any kind of binding agreement on a king, because as a king, he's above all restraint. So he got what he deserved. And it's fascinating going back to the 1600s and reading how thoughtful that the British and the English were on that, because their minds were percolating and they were trying to wrestle with these fundamental questions. Nowadays, every now and then I'm shooting the bull with folks or reading what's online, and if some of these kind of basic questions come up, it might as well have been written in Greek, because folks seem tone deaf to these fundamental questions of principle and whether the government has a right.
Yes, especially speaking of the king being told that he can't do that, or so, but that's kind of like a precursor to John Marshall's dictum that, well, you can't sue the government.
Well, yeah, John Marshall did had a huge impact on creating and expanding sovereign immunity, which a lot of Americans thought at the time was a profoundly un-American notion, because in the 1770s, the Americans kicked out the Brits partly because the king was acting like he was above the law, the king and his agents. And here we are, here we have a new king with his sovereign immunity.
Yeah. Actually, I'm only concerned about my own sovereign immunity. The government's got one, and the government's only there through the consent of the governed, and I'm one of the governed, then how could they possibly have more rights than I've got?
Well, yeah, and it's my understanding there's a special category for radio hosts.
Yeah, let's not talk about that either. Before you go, you recently wrote a review in the Washington Times of a book out by Sue Eisenfeld over Johns Hopkins, Shenandoah, A Story of Conservation and Betrayal. In part, you wrote Redneck Ethnic Cleansing. That was the term you gave to that, and that few things vanish from public memory more quickly than government atrocities. Now, if anyone's taken the time to read Public Policy Hooligan, they know that you grew up right in the area of the Shenandoah National Park, and all of the things that happened in the process of creating that go into the atrocities incorporated in Ms. Eisenfeld's book. I haven't read it, but I wonder if you could tell us a little bit more about just what you mentioned in the review, especially since you were growing up there not long after all this took place.
I was growing up there in the 1960s. I was raised on a mountainside across from the start of the Shenandoah National Park. But people back then did not talk about the redneck ethnic cleansing by which the park was created. When the state government and the feds came in and just kind of tossed people off their land, and in some cases, the members of the Civilian Conservation Corps would go in and burn down people's houses to force them to leave.
Whoa.
And it was the government decided that they wanted to create a park. There were a lot of people living in that land, so they got a blanket condemnation and then basically vilified the people living there and said that they were a bunch of know-nothing sociopaths and that they were scum, as the National Park Service director said about the mountain residents. Families were paid as little as a dollar an acre for land worth 10 times that much. Government could have bought much of land that they needed for a Skyline Drive, bought it from willing sellers, but instead what they wanted to do is get a huge land grab, so which they did, and they just treated people horribly and trampled their rights.
Weren't they aware of the Supreme Court decision in Kelo v. New London about eminent domain?
Well, that was in 2006, and this was in the 1930s.
Picky. Yes.
This was the 1930s. It was started by Calvin Coolidge signed a law that would authorize creating the park, a federal park, if the state government gave the feds the land. Hoover pushed it forward. Roosevelt brought it to fruition. And also, during the Hoover administration, the Park Service had pledged that most of the people living there would be allowed to stay, but the Roosevelt administration changed their mind and kicked them off.
Oh, the kindly disposed Roosevelt administration. I seem to recall something about that. But why did they feel compelled to go through all of that tortured maneuvering when there was already an allowance for eminent domain? Or didn't national parks at that time qualify for eminent domain status?
It was being done first under Virginia law. And I don't know the exact clause in the Virginia statutes or constitution in the 1920s when this was first pushed through. But I would guess that Virginia might have been a little more property rights friendly than the federal government at that point. Mm. However, the Harry Byrd machine won this done, so it got done. And then there were all kinds of legal fights, and it's funny to see the government lawyers twisting and turning, and it was obvious that this was a whole new leap forward of government power and government seizing land and also lying about it, because the folks who were first pushing the park proposal were basically claimed that land was mostly uninhabited, but 15,000 people lived in what they proposed for the initial park. I guess 15,000 don't count. I don't know.
We don't have to worry about that now, because here in Virginia, as you know, I don't live too terribly far from where you grew up, and we now have the Dominion Power Company that wants to put a pipeline down the length of Virginia, then cut over to the coast and then down into North Carolina and so on. And the state, as I understand it, has ceded that eminent domain concept to the company.
Wow.
So if you were living at your old place and they decided they wanted to come in